Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we're seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. I'm Kent.
And I'm Nathan.
And we're talking about Nathan's book called Essential Faith, The One Element Necessary for Life. Mm-hmm. Today, we're going to continue the discussion from the previous weeks. And Nathan has a title, The Mechanics of Salvation.
Yeah.
So he's going to kind of get more in detail about the seed, Christ as the seed of Abraham.
Right, yeah. That's what I've been promising.
And
right?
Yep, and he's been laying the groundwork for that. Mm-hmm. And he's going to explain how it works. How does it work, Nathan?
Okay.
The mechanics of it.
Yes. Wow, there's so many things. Where do I even start, right? So we talked about this idea of Abrahamic faith, you know. So what we have are these figures, okay, that represent faith, or that somehow model and, in one case, mediate faith to humankind.
Mm-hmm.
So Abraham comes on the scene, and he's this pivotal figure in history. He's so far back in our, you know, in our distant past that he's almost mythological. Maybe he is, you know, for many people that we talk about the Abrahamic religions. Right. Mm-hmm. And so and maybe they would all contend that they're the only one. But, you know, on a global scene, the ones that claim an origin, you know, with Abraham, and those have become, you know, the dominant faiths around the world: Islam, Judaism, Christianity, monotheistic religions. So it's hard to overstate how pivotal this individual mm-hmm. has been, and what's odd about it is that he's only pivotal if all the things that were claimed about him are true. So, you know, we have this person that's almost mythological. He's so far back there that the stories about him are the only stories that are compelling about him are ones that are fantastical. You know, it's not some great say legend about an individual who accomplished a thing, right? And then we've blown them up and out of proportion. And so we magnify the things they accomplished, you know. Maybe there really was a great lumberjack named Paul Bunyan. and he was a big guy. And he was the strongest and biggest, you know. And maybe he could, you know, cut down trees and, of a certain size in one whack, you know. All that's really in the realm of possibility, and maybe that person became some tall tale, right?
Mm-hmm.
with Abraham, there's really no... So you have this layer of the Paul Bunyan story that may have been true and may have been noteworthy, may have been worth telling about, right? And then you have another layer which is probably not true, or at least stretches credulity,
mm-hmm.
right? With Abraham, all we have is the layer that stretches credulity. You know what I'm saying? Like if God didn't deal with this man, because it's the only thing that we can kind of hang our hat on as what makes Abraham different from the rest of humanity, right? At that time, what makes him worth talking about is only that God dealt with him. Okay. If God didn't deal with him, then we don't really have anything we're talking about with this guy who was just another Bedouin.
If he was just the progenitor of a nation, and for some reason we know the name of the progenitor, there's right. nothing that interesting about it.
Right. Right, yeah. I guess what would we... Rome came from Romulus and Remus, right? And so there's some myth around him.
Uh-huh.
Right? Somehow being raised by wolves and all that. and yet they likely were people, you know, and they likely had some ability to conquer others and things like that, you know. They at least did some things, right? Mm-hmm. Abraham doesn't seem to have done some things. He doesn't seem to have done anything in his life. He seemed to have traveled around and then died. If you just look at the historical events of his life, taking out, you know, if we like the whole enterprise with the historical Jesus pursuit, you know, if we have the historical Abraham pursuit, it's a guy who moved around a lot and died.
Mm-hmm.
You know? that's who you have. So how does he become this big deal? What is it about him? And so it seems that he had this, as Paul points out, this layer of trust, right? That it is his encounters with God, or his supposed encounters with God, that matter. Mm-hmm. And that make him noteworthy and somebody worth talking about. So we're kind of in a double bind. He's either nothing or he's crucial. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we can't leave him behind. You know, it's like, and this is what's, I think, so different about the Christian faith than subsequent religions that would come on as a corrective measure. Okay. So we have this narrative about religions that every so often they have to be updated. You know, so as far as I know, Islam came about as an attempt to correct what had gone wrong, right?
With Judaism and Christianity.
Right, yeah. So, you know, I think that, I suspect that Muhammad meant well. And that he probably did have some kind of a supernatural encounter with something. And that something left him with the impression that he was called to settle differences that he saw as lamentable in his world. Okay. And then that became what, you know, eventually, yeah, I think it grew into a thing that is probably not helpful, but at any rate. But the narrative there is that there are people that God has dealt with, that he's revealed truth to. Those people were unworthy and therefore have somehow altered the truth or whatever, right? That the truth that God revealed in a text was somehow mishandled and therefore distorted to the point that it's no longer effective. So God has shown up. He's called another prophet, somebody else. So, and maybe it goes back to the Bible as being revealed over the eras, you know, that it wasn't revealed in one time. And so some people would say, I mean, that someone who would like is advocating for Islam would say, well, see, then it can't be true because it's just so many different voices and you really just need one voice. Okay. But the narrative goes that the story was true at first, but then has become perverted and now is being corrected.
Okay.
And so we have versions of that throughout history.
Mm-hmm. We have versions of that in Christianity.
In Christianity, of course. Yeah, I was a part of one of those movements. Okay, that so you have, as I'd mentioned before, the Restoration Movement. Right, mm-hmm. It's a group of people saying, "Hey, the Reformation, what Luther discovered, and legitimately there were some things that were broken or wrong." Mm-hmm. Right, when people get involved in divine truth and they mediate it, something goes wrong. Okay. So that's the story. But what I think is strange about and wonderful about Christianity is that when it came on the scene, there was no attempt to write a corrective book. There was no claim that the previous book was an error. You know, that's what's strange about it is that it's this revelation of the thing that you already have, right, that is perfect and from God and holy. You know, I mean, the writers of the New Testament would have never disparaged the scriptures. And they didn't claim until much later when you get to 2 Peter, where he refers to Paul's writings as scriptures, which scripture just means writings, you know. So I don't know that even he's necessarily elevating them to the same level, but they're written guidance from God, right? Mm-hmm. Scriptures. And even during the first century, there wasn't some sort of singular bound volume that everybody agreed. You know, there was generally a canon of about 50 books, and some were adopted and some were left behind. There were groups that only accepted the Pentateuch. There were groups that accepted the others, you know. So anyway, there were disagreements about the holy books, but those who were advocates for the gospel would have said that they're from God. They're all from God, right? All 50. And they spent a lot of time in the Psalms. But so Paul, when he's preaching this gospel, what's amazing about it is that he doesn't just retain Abraham as the progenitor of this faith movement, but he kind of really elevates him in the sense that he becomes such a pivotal figure, you know, that it's almost like his gospel is, he's reaching behind Moses to get Abraham back, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, You can think of what I'm referring to. What do you think? What comes to mind when I say that?
Well, I think that struck a chord with me when you said it, because he does that in Galatians, I think. Reaching behind Moses to get Abraham back. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I just know that that rings a bell for me.
Sure.
That rings bells.
You've studied Romans, right? Mm-hmm. So, and Galatians, especially those books, because he's dealing with Jewish believers. So it seems that the Roman context is one where you have Jewish believers who are returning to Rome to find a standing Gentile church, and they're trying to integrate back. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the question of who's right, who has a claim on Abraham, what needs to happen with these Gentiles so that they can be a part of the people, right? Mm-hmm. The nation. Because the Jews, even though they were in these exilic communities throughout the world, saw themselves as a nation, not just a congregation. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of overlap there. But how do these people join us? How are they a part mm-hmm. of our movement? And so that's a question there with Galatians, as you know, famously, that there were people who were of Jewish background who were trying to convert these Christians. They saw this as a moment when these Gentiles are interested in Yahweh, and so they see it as an opportunity to proselytize mm-hmm. a bunch of Gentiles at once. So the Jews are
of Moses, and that's an argument in Paul. Like, you guys are of Moses, mm-hmm. but I'm going all the way back to Abraham
yeah.
and his faith,
right?
Which is where you're leading to.
Right, yes.
And he's going to say, these Gentiles are of the faith of Abraham.
Right.
And that trumps
exactly
being followers of Moses.
Exactly, exactly. So there's really, and it's not that Paul, so Paul positions, if you think, like if you're a Jew, and you look back at your lineage, okay, and what you see is, let's say, the big figure closest to you in time maybe is David, okay? And then behind David is Moses, right? Mm-hmm. And behind Moses is Abraham, okay? So, and these guys are lined up, and you really cannot see Abraham back there. You just know that he contributed to Moses, and Moses contributed to David. Mm-hmm. And so they get like this, you know, tertiary credit, you know, for bringing about the nation as it is. And it, now, what Paul would do is that he would take that perspective and he would turn it 90 degrees so that you see Abraham, Moses, and David on a plane perpendicular to where you're standing. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he would take them as Moses or Abraham as directly the progenitor of those who have faith, not the progenitor of the one who gave the law, who gave the kingdom, who gave us ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a big difference. Even though he's retaining all of them and drawing from all of them, he's looking at them from a different point of view. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's keeping the same book, but he's flipped it 90 degrees, and now he's saying, look, and I'm saying this because Paul says the law came in beside, right? So we would, the Jews would say, well, the law came in on top, you know, and that everything that happened with, they would be more dispensational in that they're saying everything that happened with Abraham was preparatory to everything that happened with Moses, right? And that everything that happened with Moses ultimately led to everything that happened with David, and we want to get back to the Davidic kingdom so that we can fully live as realized Jews in the world, okay? But Paul would say, no, that's not exactly how it was always supposed to work, right? That all of it was about this broader sweeping vision, not just this tribal vision, but a vision of the whole world coming to God. But the way that was going to happen was not through Moses, but through Abraham. Because Moses brought us this vehicle, this thing that was supposed to keep the Jewish people, right, until such time as this figure arrives who's supposed to bring the Abrahamic faith to humankind. So that's the way Paul saw. So he keeps it all, right? He doesn't he doesn't let go of a jot or tittle, as you know we see in the Gospels, right? One stroke of a pen is not removed. Okay, it's not like he becomes a textual critic of the, you know, the Torah and the Tanakh, and says, "Oh, these parts are right and these parts are wrong," like subsequent progenitors of religious faiths. But that he would say, "No, it's all correct, 100%. Don't let go of a single shred of it. But we just have to understand how it's aligned."
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes, I think, the critical thing. So Paul would say that God made a covenant with Abraham, and that covenant included his inheriting the entire earth. Okay. And he made it on the basis of a promise. So I'm just kind of giving you a summary synopsis of the book of Romans. Right. And that promise was predicated not on performance of a prescribed standard, but on this thing that Paul calls faith. So he's just saying, look, when God wanted to bring about a race of people who are near him, right, who are his friends, that he did it on the basis of their trust, not on the basis of a prescribed set of behaviors. So then, you know, so in a sense, he is doing kind of a restoration mentality. He's just saying, look, the original relationship was one that God himself secured, you know, that he didn't make it dependent on human performance. And he would say, look, and this is what scripture teaches us, you know. So let's just take, for instance, if scripture was trying to teach us that Abraham, because he trusted God, was blessed with a successor who was Moses, who gave us law. Okay. If, if that's the way we see things, then God has now move the goalpost, right? He's made it based on performance. But also, if you look at the story, that he's made it impossible, okay? Because what happens, you know, the 2 weeks after the Israelites receive the law?
Right. They break the law.
They break the first two immediately, right? Mm-hmm. Don't worship any other gods. Don't make any graven images. They're like, great start. You know, it's almost like a laundry list of what to do, you know, when they get this law. And it's not like the law could have come in any way that was more impressive. It's not like there was something wrong with their motivation. It's not like there's something wrong with the circumstances. You know, it's not like, well, if they'd been saved from more dire circumstances, or if they'd been saved in a more dramatic way, you know, if they'd received the law in some way that was going to, you know, just gonna blow them away even more. It's like, no, you know, they get every possible opportunity to conform to law and they don't. So if the point of the Old Testament scriptures is God did all of this to give us a law that he expects us to follow, then that's not the way the story goes. Right. So, Paul, I would say, you know, who's bringing together, who's harmonizing more of the text? You know, if you're asking who's the better expositor of a religious text, you know, then I think that we would ask, well, whose model is, just like any theory,
explains the data more fully.
Exactly. Right. So any theory of everything, right? Mm-hmm. It's got to take into account the data that we have.
Yeah.
And I think that's true when we're dealing with a religious text. So, you know, if someone were to say, well, the purpose for us is to obey the rules, well, you're going to have a hard time making that case from the text, okay? Because the whole scriptures start with the story of two people in an ideal environment living in fellowship with God who immediately disobey the one rule they have. You know? That if the idea that people can't follow rules is not embedded in this, then I don't know what is, you know. So that, and, you know, is that just to tell us that we're failures and we should always just, you know, carry around a board and hit ourselves in the head with it every so often to remind ourselves? I don't think that's the purpose, right? But here's this one that seems to be some sort of a success, right? That from the time of his calling on, he obviously has some foibles, but God doesn't seem to hold that against him. It's not like God's mad about it. You know, he does some stuff that we wish he wouldn't do as we're looking back on it. But God never indicts him for that at all. Actually, God stands up for him. You know, in the case of Abimelech, he lies about Sarah being his sister, or he tells the truth about Sarah being his sister, depending on your perspective. And Abimelech takes her home, right? And now she's in his harem, and God strikes Abimelech, not Abraham. You know, and Abimelech's, you know, Abimelech's a righteous guy. Like, if we look at it, we think, dude, you know, and Abimelech could protest that. He's like, man, I didn't do anything. Why am I getting, you know? And God's like, well, this guy's my friend, right? Mm-hmm. He's my prophet. And you make restitution to him. It's like, what? You know, it's kind of like the guy that old Cheney shot in the face, having to publicly apologize to Cheney for putting his face in front of his gun. You know, you know, it's all about privilege, mm-hmm. right? And Abraham is privileged in a way that is strange to us, I think. But it does say something about that relationship, right? That, what is it? The client-patron relationship, okay? So God institutes this client-patron relationship. We're not used to that language. But it is in, so there's a book called Misreading Scripture Through Western Eyes. It's mm-hmm. pretty good. I mean, there's some stuff. Like, it's one of those books where all of it's pretty good, but really it's got some nuggets in there that, you know, you just really need. Mm-hmm. And one of those is this this kind of description of what was common in the ancient world, okay? So in the ancient world, you were born into the station you were going to die in, roughly, okay? There wasn't, like, Horatio Alger story, okay? Nobody rose out of their station. And so now, if that's true, and you live in that kind of world, and you are supposed to be in a relationship with the king of the universe, you know, what does that look like for you, you know? Now, there was one way up. The way up was if you were drawn up, okay? If, like, so you couldn't climb, there's no ladder, okay? But there is a helicopter, mm-hmm. you know? And so the guy's in the penthouse and there's no elevator to get up, or the elevator's secured, you can't get up it, right? Only he can go up and down. Like, so someone at the top can go down, but someone at the bottom cannot go up. Mm-hmm. That's how the social strata work. Okay. So the one at the very top reaches down, and when they do that, when they reach down to show grace, right? That's what this is to. Mm-hmm. Someone far beneath them, then that's called grace, right? They didn't have a reason to do that. They didn't need that person at all, okay? But they reach down, and what that person then is called, when they reach down and they initiate this relationship, that relationship is called friendship, right? So what does God say? He says, I've called Abraham my friend. There's a couple of places in, mm-hmm. in Scripture where Abraham bears this title, friend of God. Not son of God, right? And it's very, they're very intentional, even though Abraham is a created being. We say, well, we're all children of God, right? But Abraham is not called the child of God in any way. He's always a father, right? And so it's not appropriate, but he is a friend. God calls him his friend. And in doing that, there's something really important there that when the patron, so the person from on high, would initiate this friendship with the client, that there's really an investment of one's reputation. Like, if I say this person's my friend, that person suddenly represents me down at the lower echelon. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've really entrusted my good name to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I've allowed them access to upper echelons because of who I am. I mean, I don't think we fully understand what it's like to allow somebody to use your name. You know, it's almost like if I said, here's my gold card. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's more than that, because it's trading in social collateral. It's trading in reputation. And that's what God does with Abraham. He really reaches down, and really, to no credit, you know, Abraham could not have earned that in any way and didn't earn it. He's just a regular dude out there.
He was just chosen.
Yeah, exactly. And so Paul makes a deal out of this, right? And they understood this well in the in their world. I mean, this dynamic, it kind of reached ahead in a way with the Roman emperors, because it was common for them to do this kind of a thing. You couldn't get any higher, right, than in the human world than the Emperor of Rome, right? And so here's somebody who has a ton of grace to give, and they enjoyed giving it. Why? Because it does add to their glory, you know, in a way. So they understood the idea of this patron-client relationship maybe better than anybody until that time. So Paul's using this language, but it also tracks really close, because if you look at the Abraham story in Genesis, you don't see any kind of rules that Abraham is supposed to abide by. God just says, you know, he just gives him these promises. Now, Abraham responds by believing on some level initially, right? But what we're told that he, and this is the pivotal in, you know, Genesis 15:4, he believed God and God credited it to him as righteousness, right? And so that becomes this thing that Paul hangs his hat on, right? Paul hangs his hat on a couple of passages about faith in the Old Testament. One of them being, you know, that actually it's 6. Genesis 15:6. Abram believed the Lord and he credited it to him as righteousness. So here's this thing. Here's somebody that has not produced any kind of righteousness. So if you think about law, okay, let's say you're born a Jew, okay, and as a young Jew, you're being taught Torah, mm-hmm. Okay. Let's say you have enough privilege, at least enough leisure, that your parents ensure that by the time you're age 10, you've got the law almost pretty much memorized, right? By mm-hmm. the time you're 13, you're ready to be called a son of the law, bar mitzvah, right? So you know this stuff. Now, the law itself becomes to you, let's say, a bundle of bricks, okay? And by applying the law, you build a structure that I would call righteousness, right? Now, when that righteousness is built, whose righteousness is it?
I think it's yours.
It is, right? Mm-hmm. Right, it's yours. You built it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you piled one on top of another. You went to the trouble. Now, the bricks weren't yours. They were provided to you. That was nice. But how you put them together and that you stack them, you know, that you put in the sweat equity, it makes it your structure, okay? That's your righteousness. Now, if I say, you know, you believed in me, now here's a house, mm-hmm. right? That's what he's saying, right? He that God gave him a prefabricated dwelling, in a sense, of this righteousness. God credited it to him as righteousness, and that God's free to do that. Now, by the time Paul comes and he's preaching the gospel, that's probably a foreign idea, but it's right there in their scriptures, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other passage that he hangs his hat on is, what is it? Is it Habakkuk or Hosea? Hosea, where he says that the righteous will live by faith.
Habakkuk,
right?
Yeah, 2.
Habakkuk 2, right. So here you have this these two passages through Scripture, and Paul really returns to those multiple times. Why? Because they're there. You know, they're these kind of breadcrumbs along the way that are pointing to faith as being the point, mm-hmm. And that the law is not. So at any rate, Abraham, it has this client-patron relationship, and just like in that relationship, grace flows downward and faith is the response, okay? Mm-hmm. And that faith includes faithfulness, right? And we talked about the idea of pistis is not just to believe a thing, but it really carries this idea of somebody who has a childlike trust in another, and that trust in, you know, enables a faithfulness, a reliability. Mm-hmm. So
faith produces faithfulness.
It does.
Genuine faith.
Right.
Does.
And they're really two sides of one coin. So mm-hmm. faith kind of becomes a shorthand for both sides of that. That the subjective faith, let's call it, is resident in the person. That trust is seen through the objective faith, the faithful actions. And that where one is absent, the other is absent.
Is this why God credited it to Abraham as righteousness? Because God saw that his faith would produce faithfulness.
Yes.
It would produce righteousness.
Yes, right. Which brings together, and I think we've mentioned before, that this dichotomy that, you know, Luther basically wanted to throw away the book of James, right? Mm-hmm. Because James said that faith needs works. And Luther's concept of faith was that it was that subjective state of just trusting, and that if works are somehow associated or required, then that would negate that trust, and therefore the book of James is an epistle of straw, according to Luther, right? We could say, well, that may be true. Who knows? You know, the canon's put together by people much later, but James cites a different section, right? When Paul takes up with the Abrahamic faith, he's in Genesis 15:6, right? Mm-hmm. When James cites Abrahamic faith, he's talking about Genesis 22, right? And so, and he says, and it was fulfilled, right? That he counted it as righteousness. That Abraham's willingness to offer his son in Genesis 22 becomes the fulfillment of the faith that he had in Genesis 15:6. Mm-hmm. Because in Genesis 15:6, immediately after this great, you know, is and I don't want to blame, I don't want to accuse Paul of proof texting, but you know that. But the very next thing after this great moment of Abram believed Yahweh and it was credited to him as righteousness is, he also said to him, I'm the Lord who brought you up of Ur, and the Chaldeans give you this land, take possession of it. And Abram said, Sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will take possession of it? Mm-hmm. You know, there's still some incredulity there. And Abram, as is demonstrated by Abram's behavior, oftentimes when he does these things that we kind of wince over. I think that Abram had, you know, that thing, that kernel that God credited as righteousness, but it was also producing righteousness because, and we've mentioned this before, if we wind everything back to eternity past, before there were donkeys and oxen to lust over, you know, or whatever, to, you know, to covet, before there were people to murder and things to steal and, you know, wives to cheat on and things like that. What did righteousness look like? You know, when in eternity past all there was a relationship, right? What did it consist of? You know, so if we can boil everything down to what it means to be righteous apart from incidental righteousness, behavioral moments, you know, things that we write laws about, because we only write laws in retrospect, you know, having experienced something negative, we write a law to prohibit it. And then when someone finds a new way to do that negative thing, we have to update the law, which is why we have whole law libraries, because people have, you know, an unlimited capacity for doing evil. But before all that took place, right, what was expected? You know, well, what's expected in the garden, right? Garden of Eden. What's expected in this relationship with God? It seems to be this trust, right? This implicit trust in Him. So Abraham is the one who has it. Now Paul makes the point that that this is the essence of a relationship with God, apart from any sort of prescriptive laws. That laws, all they can do, all they've ever done, is give us an opportunity to transgress. And it's not that that's a bad thing. Right, where, as he famously says, where transgression, sin abounded, grace abounded all the more. So that's what law will do for us. But we need to get back to this initial relationship that's based on this kind of faith that produces faithfulness. Now,
and Abraham epitomizes that.
He does. And he epitomizes it because, and this point is made by several authors in the New Testament, he epitomizes it because the kind of faith that Abram had was a resurrection faith, right? Because Abram is sure that when God calls him to kill his son, his only son, his Isaac, whom he loves, you know, after God has led him to send away Ishmael, after God has affirmed that, you know, guess what? I can do anything. You know, 90-year-old woman can have a baby. You can trust me. You know, I really feel like that's a watershed moment. Like, for Abram, as his faith is developing over time, he's really not seeing a lot of fulfillment. You know, he's just moving around and being called to trust and given promises, but he's not seeing a whole lot of fulfillment along the way. And for him, I think it's a bit of an open question that's presented to him. Is anything too hard for Yahweh? Right? He's invited to wrestle with that question when he's told that Sarah will have a son. Because he laughs, right? And Sarah laughs. And so the refrain is anything too hard for Yahweh? He doesn't necessarily have the answer to that question until Isaac is born. And Isaac's name means he laughs, right? Mm-hmm. And he, in this case, is God. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if we only laugh at things that are trivial, okay? But if you're an omnipotent being, how do you decide which things are trivial, right? So famously, in Psalm 2, right? Why did the Gentiles rage and the peoples imagine a vain thing? The kings of earth conspired against the Lord and against his anointed. He who sits in the heavens laughs. Right? He laughs. It's not in derision. That's the way Abraham laughed. That's the way Sarah laughed, right? The cynical laughter. But it's the laughter that is triumphant, right? Mm-hmm. Over what may seem to be the impossible. So God laughs. What we should remember when we hear the name Isaac is that there's nothing too hard for Yahweh, okay? Mm-hmm. This is the faith that Abram had. Now, most people have not had that faith. We grow up in a place where circumstances are too big for us, and there are a lot of things that are just not funny, mm-hmm. You know? And that's how we live, okay? So how do we get from here to there, okay? And that's the question of Jesus as the seed of Abraham. So my contention is that Abrahamic faith took decades to build, right? That God accepted this very incipient form of it in that he could make a wild claim. I'm going to give you all this land. And Abraham, with no way to know the mechanics or how it was going to come about, but just trusted that that was the case, at least enough to pack up his family and move, right? So there was this degree of faith that's enough, right? And God says, okay, you trust me that much, you're my friend. But God develops it in him to the point that now he has what I would call resurrection faith. And that faith is the fulfillment, that's the saving faith. I think we only run into that faith a couple of more times, okay? Maybe David, when he's facing down Goliath, you know? I mean, he doesn't expect to get killed, but he does seem to have a bit of death-defying faith in that he trusts God enough not to act in his own interest, even in life and death moments, okay? So that speaks of saving faith. You see it in Daniel's friends, right? And Daniel and his friends, where in two cases, they're sentenced to death. So Daniel in the lion's den, his friends in the fiery furnace, right? And you see a trust that's there. So that is the faith of Abraham. That's the faith of Abraham's people, okay? But that faith is not something that's incredibly common. That's why you get this mass defection of God's people again and again, right? Mm-hmm. It's always under some kind of pressure. You know, where did Moses go? You mm-hmm. know, around the wilderness. Oh no, he's gone. What shall we do? You mm-hmm. know,
take matters into our own hands.
Exactly. It always comes. You know, Saul. Oh no, my army's leaving. You know, Samuel's not here to offer the sacrifice, and so I forced myself, right? This transgression, this violation always comes under this crucible of life and death pressure. Mm-hmm. And we feel the right. We feel entitled to at least stand up for our own survival, mm-hmm. you know? So how do we get a race of people who have Abrahamic faith, you know? Well, Paul says that it's resident in these passages about Abraham. So in Genesis 22, Abraham, you know, goes and he offers Isaac and he's told, you know, don't touch the boy. And this kindly face of God kind of appears from what is a very severe moment. So, you know, he says, don't lay a hand on the boy. And then he says, the angel of Yahweh called Abraham from the heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that you've done this. You've not withheld from me your son. I will surely bless you and make your seed as numerous as the stars in the sky. Your seed will take possessions of the cities of the enemies, and through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. Okay. Now, Paul would say that the seed, that in Hebrew, Greek, English, seed is a collective noun, right? So we can hear it as plural, and that's how it's translated in the NIV, descendants, right? But it is a singular noun in English, Hebrew, and Greek, okay? Paul makes a deal of that. You know, he says that he declared it not to your seeds. You know, he pluralizes it. Mm-hmm. He says it could have been plural, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's individual. Mm-hmm. And he further makes the claim that this seed is there. He's at that moment. He's present there. And that this oath being taken and this covenant being made is not just with Abraham, but with another individual.
Mm-hmm. His seed.
His seed. And so the seed becomes, because it's not just, it's not Abraham, through Abraham, that all the nations of the world will be blessed, the Gentiles, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. that's the point. It's not through Abraham, it is through your seed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is Paul's exposition from Romans 4 and Galatians 3 of Abraham's purpose, but also of why there was another figure of faith that needed to come after Abraham. Because Abraham's faith, as we see in the nation of Israel, is not generalizable. So he had saving faith. He had faith, a resurrection faith. Okay, but that faith, just like Abraham and Sarah, was not fertile. That there needed to be some supernatural fertility brought about if Abraham was going to become father of the multitude, which is the meaning of his name, mm-hmm. right?
If he was going to become the father of a family of faith.
Right.
Rather than just father of an ethnic group.
Right. So Abraham's faith waits for his seed, right? Mm-hmm. The one who's supernaturally born, brought into the world, the one who is the supernatural one, okay? Mm-hmm. The one who can trust God not only with the life of the most precious one to him, but with his own self, right? Because that's the real test. Not that any of us wouldn't rather give our lives for our children, but it's that when you're dead, there's nothing to salvage. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's a relinquishment of any potential. I mean, so that's the struggle, that's the challenge, right? But we see in Christ one who does that and is vindicated, okay? And that's great, that's wonderful. But the gospel isn't just that Jesus died and he rose again. If it were, we would be like, well, that's wonderful for him. What a righteous man, what a great man, what a man who trusted God, just like we do when we read Abraham. Right. And we're like, wow, that, look at that faith. That's impressive. You know, that's inspiring. I should aspire to trust God like that, but I don't, you know, because I'm not Abraham. But what Christ has done is that he died for me. And all of a sudden, his faith becomes activated. It becomes fertile. It germinates. Jesus says, you know, the one that falls to the ground and dies bears much fruit. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's for me is, it makes me its son of God, right? Because why could Christ trust God like that, right? Because he's his father, because he's the son of God. That it's not just the faith of Jesus of Nazareth. It's not just the faith of Christ the King. It is. But it's the faith of the Son of God, as Paul says. I live by the faith of the Son of God because I am a Son of God. Mm-hmm. That this is about, that this is a story, not just of the progeny of Abraham. It is. that God's promised to Abraham, you will have multitudes, that the nations will be your children, right? Mm-hmm. I've made you the father of many nations, he says in Genesis 17. But so that's a promise and God fulfills it, but God's aspiration isn't just to bring about children for Abraham, but to adopt those children as his own, to make those his children, which is the rest of the story with this client-patron relationship, okay? So the client, the patron reaches down to the client and he befriends him. But the client is still at the lower echelon. He has access, he has entree where he didn't, but he's still a slave. Okay, we'll just say that's what he is, okay? So and he can't rise out of that. And slaves, there's a major downside to slavery, and that is that you don't have an inheritance. You're working for somebody else's estate. You build somebody else's estate, and your all of your effort goes to building the legacy of another person. You have nothing to give to your children, mm-hmm. right? And your children will start over where you did at square one. That's the downside of slavery, over and above all of the suffering and everything, right? So God not only promises Abraham this relationship, this entree, but an inheritance that's at the core. Okay, but just like Abraham complains to God, how am I going to inherit if I don't have an heir? Okay, so he gives him Isaac, he's his heir, and Isaac is supernaturally his heir and all that, but that depicts, because Isaac can't be the fulfillment of all nations coming. Isaac is only the progenitor of a single nation. How will Abraham inherit everything God has promised? Okay. And that can only happen through the one who he said, through your seed, all the nations of the world will be blessed, right? So the seed comes who Paul claims is Christ. Now, how do we know he's Christ? Well, because the story of the gospel, when believed by somebody, implants in that person saving faith. Okay, and that's why in Romans 1:16-17, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, the Jew first and also to the Gentile. For therein is revealed the righteousness of God from faith, the faith of the Son, right? To faith, the faith of the sons, mm-hmm. right? For as it is written, the righteous one will live by faith, right? So, through this, that I would contend, and when he says the righteousness of God, I would contend that faith is the essence of the Son of God. Okay, that the Son's relationship to the Father has been one of eternal trust, implicit trust, right? And that this faith is now extended into the created realm, into a realm that's tainted with sin. And with Christ comes this implicit sonship trust, right? And that it is expressed and put up on display for humankind to see for all time through that crucifixion event. And the Father's faithfulness is affirmed through that resurrection event, okay? So that now, when a person hears and believes the gospel, that Christ, who is the seed of faith, comes to dwell in them through his faith, right? And now they have the faith of the Son of God. And the sons of God live in the house forever, as Jesus says, right? Mm-hmm. And that faith becomes this vehicle that sets sinners free, right? Because where does sin originate? It originates in unbelief. Mm-hmm. Okay, the one who has the faith of the Son will live righteously by whatever standard is available, whatever standard is seen in this world, but more importantly, by the divine gold standard, the righteousness of God is present in them through the faith of the Son. And so Jesus becomes the seed of this Abrahamic faith. This Abrahamic story now applies to you and me, you know, not as a third party model, but as a first party reality of something that I have imbibed by believing this story, that the story becomes the vehicle ultimately for Abrahamic faith, which means that now everyone who believes the gospel is in Abraham's lineage. And so Abraham can become the progenitor of a nation that is made up of many nations, because people do not have to change their culture, you know, or anything else in order to join. They only have to live by this resurrection faith that has been implanted in them through the proclamation. So Paul says, so faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Christ. Author of the letter to the Hebrews says, fix your eyes on Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a wonderful, wonderful story, you know, how it coheres, mm-hmm. you know, if something could be true because it's beautiful,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. right? If that's possible, if that which is most elegant ought to survive, let's say, mm-hmm. that which is most efficient, most elegant, most coherent ought to be attended to, ought to be allowed to continue to exist among it, among various iterations and variants. I contend that the gospel is that thing because of this continuity that Paul, you know, I think there, at least for me, I think we don't fully appreciate Paul's insight into all of this. For Paul, it was the great miracle of his life. Not praising the dead, whatever, you know, healing sick, you know, preaching the gospel over the, whatever, you know. But he says, you know, that I might not become puffed up because of the revelations that were given to me, a thorn in the flesh was given, you mm-hmm. know. He says to the Ephesians, and when you read, you can perceive my understanding in this mystery, you know. I mean, this just doesn't occur to people,
mm-hmm.
you know, these connections. It doesn't just occur. I really do think, you know, that there's evidence that Paul's claim of direct revelation from God is corroborated by these kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
where we're still trying to catch up to him, to be honest, you know. So,
and this living by the faith of Abraham is what sets us free. We've been saying we need to be saved from the world, the
right.
conforming authority and pressures,
mm-hmm.
and it's faith that sets us free. And now you're explaining how God has gotten faith into the hearts and minds
right.
of people all over the world, all through world history, and that
yes.
faith sets them free.
Sure.
People who study Christianity, study the Bible, kind of do learn that this argument about the faith of Abraham is now, you know, a mark of every believer.
Yeah.
But what we don't learn is that it's this resurrection faith
mm-hmm.
that we live by that sets us free from the power of sin in the
right.
world, in us and in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that and God had this challenge. He had this problem. He had to get that faith into people.
Sure. Yeah.
And the law couldn't do it. Christ did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's this dichotomy, like, so when we read our New Testament, we see several passages, Romans 3:22, Galatians 3:22, Philippians, it's always the third chapter, I guess, you know, Philippians 3, 7 through 11, Galatians 2, that where, and we've mentioned this, where it's rendered faith in Jesus or the mm-hmm. faith in the Son or the faith, you know, the faith in Jesus, Christ Jesus or in Jesus Christ. And we miss that Jesus had to trust the Father. And it's because we have we tilt towards Christ's divinity when we talk about him, and we can't imagine God having faith.
Mm-hmm.
But if God doesn't have faith, then faith isn't the righteousness of God, and then all of it, we're not,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Christ can only become the seed of faith if he's fully human to the point that he has to trust, just like we do
mm-hmm.
at the moment of our death. You know, mm-hmm. that all of that in the garden was genuine, you know, terror and grief and everything that we go through on the cusp of our own apparent annihilation, you know, mm-hmm. for what looks to us like the end of everything. I think that Christ had to have that same horizon or it's all a sham. But if he did have that and he trusted through it, then that which is the core, that which is which makes him,
mm-hmm.
that which he came to convey to us, is very real.
Mm-hmm.
And how it makes us free is you see Jesus and he's got all of these pressures,
mm-hmm.
right? And he stands unbowed and yet unreactionary, right?
Yep.
He is himself. But that's also true, as I mentioned, with Abram, you know, in offering Isaac, So I guess you would call that a kind of freedom, but I think more so we get it depicted in Daniel and his friends that you have the empire, and we're really all facing the empire, however you frame it. Mm-hmm. And you have these little, you know, disenfranchised individuals. And that's the dichotomy. That's the bold claim of John. You know, your faith overcomes the world. Who wins in that encounter between the empire and the individual? You know, well, faith, the individual with faith wins.
Mm-hmm. With the faith of Christ.
Right.
Okay, folks, thanks for listening. If you got questions, you can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Good talk. We'll see you next time.